Today's video is brought to you by Green Chef. Green Chef is the most sustainable meal kit out there, so you can, this is rather clever, enjoy your greens while being green. I mean, why not? You get to have a healthy meal and you get to, you know, do something good for the environment rather than just, oh God, I don't know, you go to the store and it's like, there's a box within a box within a bag within a bag within, like, it's just a disaster, isn't it? Not with Green Chef. Oh no. Their pre-portioned ingredients mean you'll actually reduce your food waste by at least 25% compared to grocery shopping. Which I want to say is like, not, it doesn't surprise me at all because grocery shopping is insane. Green Chef makes cooking easy so you can spend less time stressing and more time enjoying delicious home-cooked meals. Green Chef is really perfect. Like, I've said this before, I hate going to the store. I don't mind cooking. I like cooking. I hate having to go to the supermarket and pick out everything. And I always say this, but it's like, oh, so you'll go there and they won't have that one thing you need. Often I'm like, why is there no sour cream in this entire... I mean, to be fair, it's a little mini supermarket, which I generally prefer because the big ones, you're traipsing around for like an hour. But they'll just be like, there's no sour cream. So I have to go to the store on the corner as well and buy sour cream. And I've wasted like 45 minutes of my life somehow. Not with Green Chef. Everything, like I say, it just comes pre-portioned, ready to go. Deliciousness is delivered with Green Chef. They produce fresh, with fresh produce, premium proteins and organic ingredients you can trust. Green Chef is the number one meal kit for eating well. Little bit of straight up honesty here. They say, talk about your personal experience. Unfortunately, Green Chef don't ship to where I live, so I can't do that. But I do know people who've tried this and they've raved. I mean, why wouldn't you? It's delicious food that arrives at your door and you get to put it, it comes, you just prepare it super easily. It's not even complicated. Why would you not do this? Call to action must be read verbatim. Yes, sir, Green Chef. Go to greenchef.com/decoding130 and use code decoding130 to get $130 off plus free shipping. Good Lord, that's a massive discount. Brilliant. Go to greenchef.com/decoding130. Use code decoding130 to get $130 off plus free shipping. The number one meal kit for eating well. And now back to the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Decoding the Unknown. I, as always, am your host, Simon. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Today, the lost city of the Kalahari Desert, fact or fiction? Lost cities. I feel like there are lost cities which definitely existed that we found, like Machu Picchu. It's like, that was a lost city, and it's incredible we found that. And honestly, if someone had said to me, Simon, Machu Picchu's a thing before we found it, and I'd be like, meh, please, we'd have been able to find that by now. And then there's ones like Atlantis, where I'm like, well, if Atlantis is real, it's not some magical place with wizards, is it? It's just like a lost city like Machu Picchu that I don't think existed because there's not really much historical evidence for it. And I think it's mentioned. It's like one of those like Herodotus style histories where it's like, you know, mostly made up with sprinklings of fact written 200 years after anything happens. So you got to throw in like plenty of skepticism. I have no idea where the Kalahari Desert is. I mean, I do because I cheated a little bit and I was having a talk with Ilza, who wrote the script, because it's her first one before we got started. So I'm a little bit familiar with this, but not too familiar. Haven't read the whole thing. And we're going to learn about that. If it's an Atlantis one with wizards, I'm out. If it's Machu Picchu, maybe this is the next one. Let's see where we go. Thank you, Bills, for putting it together. I will now read it. As I say, it's all new to me, partially new to me. And then Jen afterwards is going to edit it and for all of our enjoyment. So let's just go. Ancient civilizations, lost cities buried beneath the deserts or hidden in the heart of a jungle protected by fierce beasts and deadly curses. Mankind's curiosity about what came before has led us to the Valley of Kings and deep into oceans, searching for mere glimpses of the fabled city of Atlantis. There we go. Yeah, it's like Valley of Kings, real. City of Atlantis, not real. Africa, considered by some to be the cradle of mankind, isn't it? Is it considered by some, or is that a proven fact now? I thought that the out of Africa theory was like so widely accepted that you don't say it's thought of by some, but it's like, no, we came from Africa. That's accepted, right? I thought that was science. I'm not sure. From the pyramids of Egypt to the lost tribes of Ethiopia in the ruins of Great Zimbabwe, ancient man's footprints can be found all across the continent. Today, however, we're heading south to the country of South Africa. Appropriately that we're going south then. Located on the southernmost tip of Africa. Shocking. Where we'll be diving into a mystery more profound than the abundance of unoriginal names. We'll be exploring the Kalahari Desert with its mysterious lost city. I went to South Africa a few years ago. My grandma lives in Johannesburg. And I didn't go to Johannesburg. I went to Cape Town because it's nicer. But no, it's a great time. Really enjoyed myself. Where were we? The year is 1885. The place, deep in the Kalahari Desert, a semi-arid region covering much of Botswana, as well as parts of Namibia and South Africa. After coming face-to-face with venomous snakes, vicious lions, and native tribes, which he described with about as much respect as you can imagine from a white man in Africa in 1885. Yeah, so unless he was extremely progressive, it was not kind. Our intrepid Canadian explorer, one Guillermo Farini. Is that how you'd say? He sounds kind of Italian, but apparently he's Canadian. I guess he could be like Italian-Canadian. He's Italian with a name like that, for real. He made an astonishing archaeological discovery. A city, undoubtedly part of an ancient civilization, buried beneath the shifting sands of the Kalahari Desert. An exciting prospect. So, who was Guillermo Farini? I'm going to look up how to pronounce his name because I'm sure he's going to be today's recurring character. And that seems like a good thing to do. G-U-I-L-L-E-R-M-O. Oh, sorry, I just mistyped it. Oh, sorry, maybe he's Spanish or Portuguese. That's what I'm getting here. I guess we'll find out, but here we go. Guillermo. Really?
Guillermo, really?
Guillermo, oh my god, I don't know. Let's just call him Guillermo. Guillermo? Forgive me, Spanish people. And Jen, oh my god, video editor Jen speaks Spanish, and whenever we get into the Spanish names, I'm always like, I'm so sorry, I feel so bad. But then again, a friend of mine's Spanish, and I talk about the hassle I get for pronunciations on, like, random words that no one has ever heard of, but of course someone on the internet's heard of. And I'm like, yo, mate, he's a YouTuber as well, but he does it in Spanish. And I'm like, yo, mate, how do you deal with it? He's like, bro, in Spanish, no one cares. We just read the word as if it was Spanish. And I'm like, that's brilliant. Why doesn't everyone do that? And I'll just be like, yeah, his name was Guillermo Farini. Guillermo. Rather than Guillermo or whatever, because two L's is a J in Spanish or whatever. No one cares. Spanish people, you can't have a go at me for this, because your language is literally, let's just pronounce it how we pronounce it. That's much better. That's a better system. Sorry, enough ranting. Let's carry on. So who was Guillermo Farini? What was he doing in the Kalahari Desert in 1885? According to some sources, Guillermo Farini, as a master of many trades, was determined to be the first man to cross the Kalahari Desert. This may be true, but in the introduction to his book, Through the Kalahari Desert, what is with the unimaginative names for shit today? First of all, South Africa, located in South Africa. Ah, terrible. This may be true, but in the introduction to his book, Through the Kalahari Desert, it appears that he was far more interested in tales of diamonds. The first diamonds had been discovered in the late 1860s and 1870s, so by 1885, the diamond rush in Kimberley was in full swing. Diamonds are the biggest ripoff. They're only rare because of an unnamed big company. I'm sure I can name the big company, but let's just not. Basically controls supply of diamonds. Diamonds are not special. They're just made special because one company holds all the supply of them. And so they're more valuable than you think. And also, by the way, if you buy a diamond from like a shop and it's like, this is a $20,000 diamond, you try sell that it's not going to be for $20,000 because secondhand diamonds, just the value of them is just basically crushed. Which, funnily enough, you could do to a diamond. Diamonds are very hard, but they are not particularly strong. In fact, you can break a diamond. Fascinating stuff, Act Boy, thank you. Attending a show at the well-known Coney Island on Long Island, New York, whoa, we're taking a jump, Farini met Kurt, or Gert in some sources, a mixed-race hunter with some San ancestry. Kurt painted a picture of paradise. Grass-covered plains, fertile savannas, and forests, teeming with game and, of course, stories of diamonds that could be found just lying about, bothering no one in the sands of the Kalahari Desert. Well, that big company's going to go to scoop all of those up. You can't have those loose diamonds all over the place. Terrible for business. Farini was a savvy businessman, among other things, and soon Kurt found himself aboard the Roslyn Castle, along with the rest of the Farini expedition, departing London for Cape Town on the 7th of January 1885. Some speculate that Kurt might have been homesick when he met Farini in New York. So he's just like, this guy loves diamonds. Yeah, man, there's loads of diamonds just outside my house. Why don't you take me to my house and I'll show you all those diamonds? Legend. If this was his way of flagging down a ride, he succeeded in spectacular fashion. The expedition. The Frini expedition was a small one. The party mainly consisted of the explorer and his adopted son, known at the time as Lulu, who turned out to be quite the photographer. The UK National Archives digitized Lulu's images and published them on its Flickr feed for the curious among you. They were also accompanied by Kurt, who would act as a guide and eventually took on a second guide, Jan, or Jan, I guess, Abrahams. Jan if he's American, Jan if he's British, and it'd be called Honza if he was Czech. I doubt he's Czech, but it's also weird. Like in Czech, the name Jan is called Honza. I don't know why. I guess that's like, it's like one of those Richard to Dick things. It's like, how do we get here? No one knows, but Honza isn't like Dick. I've got an uncle called Dick. Is that Uncle Dick? Never thought about it. It's kind of funny. I mean, I never thought about it as a kid. Two African workers or servants were also included, but unfortunately their names were never recorded. Ah, white people in the 19th century. Whether for fame or diamonds in 1880... I said that with too much. Like, yes, the good old days. No, I was being sarcastic, just in case it wasn't abundantly clear. Whether for fame or diamonds, in 1885, the Frini expedition set out from Hopetown in the Kimberley area, first heading towards Uppington, a small town established in 1873. Uppington is situated in what is today known as the Northern Cape, close to the Namibian border and the Kgalagadi Transfrontier Park. From there, they travelled east to Wilkerholt Drift, where they turn north, heading towards Lehutu and Lake Ngami in, oh my god, these place names, South Africa, Bechuanaland, today known as Botswana. After crossing the Malope River, I'm so sorry, the party came across what their guide Jan first considered to be the Kiki Mountains on the Nosob River. However, Mr. Frini, being so well versed in Kalahari geography, note the sarcasm, quickly came to the conclusion that they were too far south for the Kiki Mountains and that they had, in fact, rediscovered something long lost to the Red Sands. If you find yourself somewhat confused at this point, you're not alone. Many place names have changed since South Africa, Namibia, and Botswana gained their independence from the colonial overlords. There also seem to be some disagreements on the actual names of some places among the various sources. Add to that, Frini's an accurate map, and the party could have been on the moon for all we know. Through the Kalahari Desert, the book, published in 1886, detailed the Great Frini's adventures from, I hope he didn't call himself the Great Frini, that's a bit cringe, from discovering waterfalls to hunting giraffe and saving a dying German trader, only identified as Fritz L. It's been a didn't he forget his surname? It's like, I don't know, something long in Germany. It's about 450 pages long and not what I consider to be light reading. While it certainly has historical value, the author's racism, anti-Semitism, and his general disrespect for anyone not English grate on the nerves after a while. Ah, why would that be? I love a book that's full of anti-Semitism and general racism. It just, you know, makes it easier to read. Again, sarcasm. So I'm going to focus solely on the discovery of the ancient ruins and leave the rest of his expedition to those braver than myself. A great discovery. A half-buried ruin, a huge wreck of stones, on a lone and desolate spot. A half-buried ruin, a huge wreck of stones, on a lone and desolate spot. A temple, or a tomb, for human bones, left by man to decay and rot. Rude sculptured blocks from red sand project, and shapeless uncouth stone appear. Some great man's ashes, designed to protect, buried many a thousand year. A relic, maybe, of glorious past. A city once grand and sublime, destroyed by earthquake, defaced by the blast, swept away by the hand of time. I like reading poetry. It's all like, you know, thought out and I love it. I just enjoy it. It's a poem by the dude. Based off Rooney's own book, lectures and interviews, as well as research done by fellow explorers over the last 100 years, it's clear that at this point, their expedition, that the party was hopelessly lost. So, until we rediscover this fabled city, we have only Farini's description of the ruins, which is quite detailed considering they only explored them for about 3 days. Camping near the foot of what was not the Kiki Mountains, beside a long line of stone, definitely was the Kiki Mountains, wasn't it? Farini's first impression was that the line of stone, presumably a wall, looked like the Chinese wall after an earthquake. Upon closer inspection, they found the ruins and extensive structure, in some places buried beneath the sand. According to the explorer, they traced this wall for nearly a mile and described it as mostly a huge heap of stones, all flat-sided, with cement visible between the layers. The general outline of the wall was an arc, and inside the arc, at intervals of about 40 feet, were heaps of masonry in the shape of an oval. It was about a foot and a half deep, with a flat bottom, and hollowed out at the sides about a foot from the edge. A foot is about 30 centimeters for all our European friends, and everywhere else in the world. Some of the heaps inside the arc were cut from solid rock, while others were formed from more than one piece of stone fitted perfectly together. Most of the heaps appeared to have been buried beneath the sand, and after a day of digging, which the local tribesmen accompanying them on this leg of the journey found entirely pointless, Freely came to the conclusion that what they must have found had must either have been a city or a place of worship, or in his words, the burial ground of a great nation. It's grandiose, isn't it? I mean, I get it, though. Like, you're some ancient historical explorer who wants to set out to discover cool things and write books and shit. Like, blowing up and blowing things out of proportion is going to be, like, easier. Because you don't have people fact-checking you all the time, do you? It's like the 19th century. You could just say what you want and people will be like, yeah, sure. Be like, you know, drugs back in the day. People are like, yeah, take this. This Eye of Newt works great. Doesn't, though, does it? Doesn't do anything. Perhaps 1,000 years old. At this point, Jan made it clear that his people would not be digging out old rocks. They had had a successful hunt and were eager to return home to their wives. Farini insisted on staying to explore the ruins further. Jan and the hunters were there as their guides, not cheap labor, and they left the crazy Europeans to waste their strength by digging in the sands while going hunting. In his book, Farini, perhaps a bit petulantly, stated that the digging was much easier without the help, though I find that hard to believe. He's just like, it's easier without you. I didn't even want you here anyway. So the next day, without help and witnesses, the party continued their exploration and made astounding discoveries. Digging down in the middle of the arc, they came across a pavement about 20 feet wide made of large stones forming a Maltese cross. In the center of the cross was the base of a monument, or possibly an altar or column composed of loose pieces of fluted masonry. According to his book, Lulu Farini looked for hieroglyphics or inscriptions but couldn't find any, so he made sketches of the ruins, which Farini then intended to give to those more knowledgeable on the subject to decide who once occupied this amazing city in the middle of the desert. Of course, providing correct coordinates or a more accurate map of where to find these ruins would have made this task a lot easier. The hunt for a lost city. While there wasn't much interest initially, starting around 1933, at least 30 documented expeditions have been launched into the heart of the Kalahari Desert looking for the elusive lost city. Interesting things have been found. A city is not among them. So that was enough for people back in the day. 30 expeditions at no doubt enormous cost were sent off to find this, like, lost city, just based on some dude who was like, yeah, I went on an expedition. Did he find anything? No, I did. I definitely did. It wasn't a waste of money. I found a city. I definitely found a huge city. Definitely go check it out. Great, yeah. Well, where is it? Oh, I don't know. We didn't write it down. People in the past, man. Going through all these expeditions in detail will take forever and a day, and since I'd like to write for this channel again, I'm not going to make Simon read 20 pages of explorers documenting interesting rocks, insects, plants, and the woes of their uncomfortable journeys into the interior of the Kalahari Desert. It is much appreciated as a thank you. Traveling through the Kalahari today requires a powerful aircon and careful planning to replenish water supplies and to do vehicle maintenance. So imagine doing it in 1933 without Google Maps and an Engen 1 stop every 50 kilometers. What is an Engen 1? Fuel stations with tuck shops and bathrooms for those unfamiliar with South Africa. Well, thank you. Tuck shop is not a phrase I have heard in a very long time. I guess it's what South Africans call like a grocery? Like a, you know, like that little grocery bit that you get in a petrol station? Tuck shop is what we called it at school. Like where there was like the building where you'd go and they'd sell sweets and toasties and stuff like that. That was the tuck shop. So, to preserve everyone's sanity, let's focus on a few of the more influential expeditions. While interest in the Lost City was rekindled in 1923, Professor E.H.L. Schwartz, a professor from Rhodes University in Grahamstown, the first expedition dedicated to finding the Lost City of Kalahari, left in 1933 and was led by two South Africans, F.R. Paver, editor of the Johannesburg Sun newspaper, and Dr. W. Meet Brohards, a physician from Uppington. Before setting out, Paver made a thorough study for his expedition and decided to focus his search on the middle river of the three Nosob tributaries. Oh my gosh, I have no idea where any of this is. A dry riverbed known at the time as the Molotsewany River. There's so many place names and stuff. I'm a little bit lost. I love the bit of history. It was like about a siege of a city. I won't be more specific than that. But the writer wrote it for me. And there were so many place names in history. I was like, my dude, you got to write this for someone who's not as clever as you. Because I was just so lost. I was like, wait, where's this place again? Who's this guy? Like, constantly sprinkle throughout the guy who did this. Because old Simon has to read this. And he's like, he gets lost very easily. I was like, make it for more stupid people, please. On the way north, using a car and a light truck, the expedition picked up a desert trader named Euster, a young farmer from Gordonia, Nicholas Coetzee, a local, probably Cajun guide. According to Coetzee, while hunting east of the Nosob River, he came across an arrangement of stones very similar to what Farney described in his book. Being in a hurry at the time, he didn't bother to explore the place and only had a rough idea of where to find it. So, off the party went, sometimes burning as much as a gallon of gas for every 7 miles as they fought through the heavy sands. They decided to follow the dry riverbed of the Molotsewany River, but lost the tributary on the first day. On the second, their guide admitted that it never actually come this far. They passed Dimpo Ban, reaching the edge of the dune country with no sign of a city. Returning to Nosob by a different route, they found limestone formations, but decided that Farini, being intelligent and observant, couldn't have mistaken the limestone for the ruins of a city. I don't know if Farini comes across as, like, super intelligent or observant. He just comes across as, like, a bit too sure of himself, in my opinion. Despite not finding any trace of a city, both Paver and Brohards firmly believed in the city's existence. Sometime later, Paver wrote in a letter that, quote, "You could spend months in the sand dunes without covering a fraction of the area in which the lost city could be located." 3 years later, in 1936, a South African writer and journalist, Lawrence Green, set off on a six-day expedition covering the area north of the Paver and north of the Paver and Brochard's expedition site. In his book, he describes traveling through desert that no man had camped before. Green describes spotting a limestone outcropping, a line of sand hills, an unmapped river, and a single well. He came to the conclusion that the best way to search for the elusive city would be by aeroplane. I mean, yeah. Wait, they did have aeroplanes. Did they have aeroplanes? When was this? This was like after the 1930s, 1920s? Yeah, 1930s. You got aeroplanes, my dudes. But I guess if they're buried under the sand, that's not going to be super helpful. Aren't they now using? Was that what technology were they using to find like ruins in the Amazon? Like ancient ruins? It wasn't LIDAR or something, or radar or something, like to scan beneath the canopy of trees, because normally you can't see what's down there and it's absolutely massive. I mean, until they finally log everything, we won't know. But apparently there's some like new technology they can use to like scan through the forest and see what's down there. And I'm like, that's some pretty Indiana Jones. There's going to be some cool stuff down there for sure, like a Temple of Doom or something. I've got a friend who's a real-life archaeologist, and it's less Indiana Jones, and it seems more about just carefully documenting stuff and then spending a lot of time in front of a computer or in a laboratory. And I'm like, it's still pretty cool. Archaeology's cool. But I mean, I'm always disappointed he's not like got a cool hat and a whip. But I guess, you know, that's the reality of life. Maybe he does have a cool hat and a whip. I bet he would. He probably does. He just doesn't take them to work. After returning to Cape Town, Green met up with Brohards again, who told a story he had heard that gives even more veracity to the tale of a lost city. According to Brohards, a police sergeant told him of his own discovery in the Kalahari in the area of the lost city while patrolling on Camelback. Apparently, the sergeant came upon an ancient stone quarry. Some of the stone had been squared on the spot and was still there. Close by, buried in the sand, the sergeant found what appeared to be the remains of a boat about 14 feet in length. This was not the only story, of course. Native tribes had stories about a place in the desert where people once lived. I mean, this all does sound really interesting, but it is very much like a guy told a guy. Like, I heard from my mate who heard from the policeman that he found a boat in the desert. And you're like, okay, so that means a boat might be there. It doesn't necessarily mean it is. And all these expeditions went to find the stuff and they found nothing? They were really looking hard. Although it was really big. But then one guy found it. Allegedly. Two farmers, who didn't want to be identified as they were poaching at the time, claimed to have stumbled across the lost city, and Scotty Smith, a well-known Kalahari adventurer with a somewhat liberal interpretation of the law, also spoke of visiting the ruins. After these two expeditions, a great many followed. It soon became clear that Farini's map and direction in his book were somewhat accurate, and the search area was expanded. As technology advanced, so did search techniques, and soon light aeroplanes were used. So far, Farini City has not been found, but the searches have not been entirely fruitless. In around 1951, the French writer and traveller François Bazin discovered, I'm not entirely clear how or where, that there were two old roads now buried connecting the Nosob with the Central Kalahari. He theorised that the Nosob might have been a convenient route for trade caravans, suggesting the need for a base camp of sorts somewhere in the area. On the eastern side of the Nosob River, about 20 kilometres north of Kaikai, he discovered the stone quarry Brochard's mentioned years earlier. Though there's no mention of a boat. It was small and round, essentially stone stacked in a circle, and he came to the conclusion that it most likely served as a gathering place for the San people in the region. I mean, yeah, but it's not a city, is it? It's a big difference between, yeah, some rocks they've been stacked up for a mine compared to, like, there's a city. Barzan's expedition also found traces of ancient people in rock paintings depicting water, hunting, and fishermen. Clearly, there had been a civilization in the ancient Kalahari. Their city, however, remained elusive. Probably the most significant expedition was that of A.J. Clement in 1965. After carefully studying Farini's book, calculating distances and the speed at which the expedition most likely travelled, Clement came to the conclusion that the ruins of the lost city, if it existed, would be located closer to Ryetfontein, a town north of Upington, near the Namibian border, south of the Molopo River, not north, and nowhere near the Nosob River, as far as I can tell. I'm a little bit lost, but so the directions just weren't very good, were they? The Clement expedition set out on Easter Monday, and they were not disappointed. Around 15 miles outside of Ryetfontein, they came across a site called Eardop Kopjes, which translates to the more easily pronounceable Eggshell Hills that closely resembled Farini's description. Bingo! They actually did it, I guess. Or close to. They found a large oval-shaped amphitheatre about a mile in length. And in several places, there was a striking resemblance to a double wall. There was just one problem. This site was not the ruins of an ancient city. What? They found an amphitheatre about a mile in length. Where else would you have an amphitheatre a mile in length? What Clement found and what he believed Farini described are natural rock formations, the result of weathered dolomite intrusions. Oh, okay, so an amphitheatre, you'd be like, okay, it's the shape of an amphitheatre. So you could call it an amphitheatre. So yeah, I guess this guy, this does seem like a likely explanation. I think probably, in my mind, so far, what he discovered was natural rock formations. And what he really wanted in his mind was to discover a city. So either he was like, he convinced himself it was a city, or he just lied and was like, yeah, no, I found a city. Just to self-aggrandize himself. Just to aggrandize himself? But that doesn't sound right. Do you aggrandize something? I guess so. That's totally a word. He was just looking to aggrandize himself, basically. Or he just convinced himself it was a city. Or maybe it was really city-like, but that seems a bit unlikely. However, his descriptions, despite this not being a city, seem to coincide with what Farini himself discovered in 1885. In his paper on Farini's lost city, Clement states that some of the boulders could easily be confused with square building blocks, while one or two rocks showed some fluting and were encrusted with a mortar-like substance. Yeah, that just entered my mind while I was reading that. It's like, weren't they kind of pasted together? Which Farini could have mistaken for cement. There were several examples of flat rocks perched on underlying rocks like tabletop, and Clement feels that at least one of these, more impressive than the rest, resembled one of Lulu's illustrations. Apparently, the mystery had been solved. However, not everyone is convinced, so the expeditions continued.
Yeah, I'm like, that's it. This is it. although it was almost like it didn't exist. And am I going to be proven wrong? I don't know. Let's find out. I don't think so, though.
In 2002, Greg Van der Raets led an expedition into the Kalahari Desert, deciding to start at the original coordinates that Farini mentioned in his presentation to the Royal Geographical Society. While they agreed that the coordinates are probably not accurate, it's not like anyone else had found anything in the last 100 years, so they figured it's a good place to start as any. While they did find traces of civilization in the form of dry walls and Stone Age tools, they didn't appear to be any closer to finding the lost city itself. In 2016, the reality TV show Destination Unknown. Destination. What's that song? You know, Destination Unknown, it's a song. Reality TV's got to step in. The problem is they won't find it in season one. They'll be like, yeah, we got to spin this out to 5 seasons. Like, one of my favorite episodes that we've done so far is the lost treasure of that island. What was that stupid island called? It's near Canada or whatever. And the History Channel's making like a 5-season show where they're like, looking for the lost treasure. And there is no lost treasure, but somehow they have found treasure because they found treasure in advertising dollars, spinning that out for 5 seasons. It's incredible. Presenter Josh Gates and local explorer Adam Cruz used the photographs taken by Lulu to map their route instead of Farini's map and narrative. Credit where credit is due, this is not a bad idea. Their search focuses on the Agrabes area, and like many expeditions before them, they find traces of civilization in the form of etchings and rock art, but no sign of the city itself. It appears that the search for the mysterious city had finally left the realms of hard science and ventured into the field of entertainment. I have a feeling that Farini would have been proud. Yeah, he was definitely writing that book. It's like, yeah, semi-factual, semi-entertainment, which I kind of, yeah, I get that. Like, you know, Bill Bryson's books. I mean, they're just factual, right? But it's like, they're so entertaining. Like that Short History of the World or whatever it's called, The Short History of Nearly Everything. It's like, yeah, it's non-fiction, but it's also like that blur of entertainment. Why? I'm just realizing this is kind of what I do, like that meeting point of education and entertainment. I guess I do it because I like it. So, is any of this real? We haven't actually answered the big question yet. Are there ruins of an ancient civilization buried beneath the sands of the Kalahari Desert? To answer this, we need to consider probably the two most influential people in this mystery: the great explorer who made the discovery, G.A. Farini, and the work of A.J. Clement. So, who exactly was Guillermo Farini? Born on the 10th of... Wow, we're really late in the video to be introducing this guy. I mean, to a deeper level. On the 10th of June, 1838, in Lockport, New York, as William Leonard Hunt. Oh, he changed his name. Into a rather conservative family, Hunt was raised in Bowmanville near Port Hope in Canada and is still considered one of Canada's most famous sons, and not without good reason. Wait. So did he change his name? I'm so confused. I guess he must. Hunt had a pretty amazing life. There might be a biographics video in there. Indeed. His father wanted him to become a doctor, but Hunt had other plans. Okay, as a young man, he changed his name. Okay, to Signor Guillermo Antonio Farini and threw himself into showbiz. I missed a trick. I should have changed my name from the boring Simon Whistler to something Spanish sounding, something more exotic. That way this entertainment biz would be easier. This got him disowned by his father, but it didn't prevent him from having an astounding career as an acrobat, stuntman, promoter, businessman, and for even serving a stint in the army. Okay, so this guy who wrote this book, he's an entertainer. He's not an academic. It would be if I wrote a book trying to be smart. People would be like, is that embellishment fact, boy? That sounds like something you made. That sounds like one of your stories rather than something that someone wrote for you that you read. Because the people who write your stuff are smart. You're less so, fact boy. The great Farini was probably best known for his stunts crossing Niagara Falls. Walking on a tightrope, he crossed Niagara Falls multiple times, doing all sorts of stunts along the way. Standing on his head, walking on stilts, climbing down to the Maid of the Mist pleasure boat, taking tourists up close to the falls. I've done that. It's quite fun. And having a glass of wine before climbing back up the ropes to continue his stunt. But his career was not limited to the US and Niagara Falls. Farini performed all over the world, including in front of the Prince of Wales. Sadly, his career also caused the death of his wife, Mary Osborne, when a tightrope stunt went wrong in Havana, Cuba, and she fell to her death. Wait, so she was a stunt tightrope walker as well? I don't think he caused her death then. She died on a tightrope. She caused her own death. Unless he was like, Mary, get up on that bloody tightrope. And she's like, Guillermo, I don't even know how to walk on a tightrope. Get up there, bloody hell, woman.
In his 30s, aware that his acrobat days were behind him. Oh no, I'm in my 30s. It's too late. It is kind of like intense how, like, it's weird, like, you cross that line. I still feel I'm young, but it's like there's certain things that is the absolutely no chance that I'll ever do. And it's kind of weird to think. And I'm totally okay with it, but it's like, I'm never going to be a professional athlete. Not that that was ever on the cards, but now it's like, literally, those years have passed me by. Like, I can't do that anymore. It would be physically impossible. Like, as impossible as it would be for me to become a pianist, for example, if I just gave up everything right now and just started learning piano like a maniac, it's entirely possible that I could become a fantastic, like, pianist who plays in a concert. It's possible. I mean, I don't think it's very likely, and I'm definitely not going to do it. But, like, the idea is, like, even if I, like, learned tennis every day and was, like, absolutely 100% dedicated to it, it'd be like, there's no chance. I'm 34. Already people who are 34, it's like, that's at the tail end of a career, unless you're Roger Federer. Wow, that was a detour. Where were we? He became a promoter. Oh, yeah, so he can't be an acrobat anymore. So he became a promoter and a manager for other acts such as Crowd, Missing Link. Okay. Freddy was also an inventor. We can thank him for the flip seats in movie theaters. No, really? I mean, I guess, like, someone had to invent that. But I just assumed that was something that, you know, people are like, this is inconvenient. Let's just make these go up. I didn't realize it was a specific invention. Well, kudos. And a savvy businessman. Instead of simply passing a hat whenever he did his tricks, he negotiated sponsorships for his stunts and even managed to get a share of the train tickets sold to tourists flocking to Niagara Falls to see him perform. That is some seriously good business right there. Although, did he have to have money? I feel like if you invented the flip movie theater seats, you're good for life. Everyone's using those. You gonna get a patent on that or something? That's gonna make you like a billionaire. It's like that movie Garden State where the guy, he's like, it's like, wow, how did you get this big house? What happens? And he's like, oh, I invented silent Velcro. It's like legend. And now he's just bored. Maybe he was just bored. But like flip seats in movie theaters feels like, you know, the sort of plot point of a movie where how someone got rich. Finally, Freeney served in both the Union Army during the American Civil War, where he devised a way to cross bodies of water, hopefully not using a tightrope, and during World War I, translating German stories on the war effort. He was an explorer, a self-taught botanist, and even a painter. He does sound like, I don't know, like, respect. Like, all of this stuff you've done is like, any one of these things, inventing flip movie seats, becoming a botanist, translating German, serving in a war, these are things that most people won't do. And he did them all. Kind of a legend. So there's no denying it. Freeney was no hack. He was smart, charming, and accomplished a great deal more in his career than most of us ever will. Yeah, he accomplished a great deal more in any of his careers than most. Like, most inventors don't invent something as profound as the flip seats in a theater. Maybe profound's the wrong word, but, like, useful, commonplace. So, did the showman lie about finding a lost city in the Kalahari Desert? Some people think so, and considering that the city still hasn't been found over 100 years later, it's difficult not to ask that question. In Freeney's defense, at the time of his expedition through the Kalahari, the desert was not as well documented as it is today. As we already saw, Freeney's map is considered incorrect, so it's quite possible that the expedition was nowhere near where they thought they were. On top of that, it was Freeney's first time in Africa, and the Kalahari had some unique rock formations that someone with no training or experience in geology could easily misinterpret. Yeah, that's the thing. He's not academic. He's an entertainer. And I'll be like, wow, that's a really square rock. Someone carved that. And they'd be like, no, it's just the result of natural geological formations. I'd be like, but look how square it is. And then they'd be like, Simon, we're geologists. This is what we do. You have to believe us. And I'll be like, okay, fine. Fine. And people who don't believe this are the same people who are like, I don't want to listen to science. I think that God can heal all my ills. It's like, yeah, but no. He can't at all. I'm going to pray that COVID away. However, Freeney was an entertainer. When it came to telling stories and giving people what they wanted, the man was good at what he did. Discovering a lost civilization in a place where few people could contradict him could translate into fame and money. Two things he definitely likes. It's also quite notable that there doesn't appear to be any clear photos of these ruins, only watercolor illustrations. The second thing we need to consider is the expedition and findings of A.J. Clement. Clement made a very detailed study of Ferrini the man and his expedition and found some interesting discrepancies. One of Clement's first concerns, and a very important one when retracing someone's steps to find a lost city, is exactly how far Ferrini actually travelled. Clement looked at Ferrini's dates of arrival and departure in South Africa based on booking records, his time travelling by train to Hopetown and back, and deducted an estimated time for stopping during his trek to rest and explore, as recorded in his book. So they're using the kind of, like, qualitative stuff in his book to make a map. That's cool. And it's concluded that Ferrini was only travelling for about 125 days. If he did go all the way to Lake Ngami and back, he must have averaged 60 miles a day. With an ox-drawn wagon, this is simply not possible. Yeah, that's really far through the desert. I was just making a video about... Oh, yeah, it was people... It was when the Ottomans marched through, like, Hungary, and they were marching through, like, a swamp or something, which I imagine is similar to, like, a desert, and they were going so slowly, because you're getting bogged down, you're sliding. Yeah, not a good time. Was it that, or was the one about traveling slow in the desert as well? I make a lot of videos. I get confused easily. Secondly, it appears that Ferrini himself either became confused or purposefully changed the route his expedition took. In a newspaper interview with a journalist from the Cape Argus newspaper, immediately upon his return, he described his outgoing route to be via the Nosob River to Lahututu. However, in his book and lectures produced sometime after his return, he appeared to have turned north at Wilkerhout Drift and reached Lahututu via a place called Kuis on the Malope River. Either Ferrini wasn't entirely sure of the route of his expedition, or he intentionally changed the route, perhaps to make his journey appear longer than it really was. Regardless, this change immediately throws everything into question. If the explorer himself was uncertain regarding the actual route he took, it's entirely possible that he was mistaken as to where he found the ruins. If he was fabricating a part of his journey, are there any ruins to start with? Of perhaps a more subjective nature, as people's memories can be flawed, in the Johannesburg Star of October 1923, an interesting comment appeared. An old Kalahari hunter, Tasker, was shown a picture of Ferrini posing next to a dead giraffe. Tasker claimed that Ferrini's book was made up of a collection of hunters' tales and that the man himself never went further than Kuis. Paver and Brochures, the first expedition in 1933, also interviewed an old farmer in Upington. The man remembered Ferrini but stated that the explorer had only been away for about 6 weeks, that is not nearly enough time to trek all the way across the Kalahari and back. De Clement agrees that Ferrini definitely travelled through Upington and at least as far as Mere, Rietfontein, today, as his descriptions of the terrain are correct. Whether he went much further is unclear. This is just one thing we just can't know. And there's so many questions around this that I'm like, I think maybe he just discovered those geological formations. I'll give him that. But there's too many questions around this for it to be as he said. And there's too many questions around, not his character, but he's like an entertainer. He's not this academic dude. Dr. Hans Schintz, a German missionary and scientist, travelled in the Kalahari extensively between 1884 and 1887. When questioning Europeans living in Guernsey, as well as the Bechuana people living on the shores of Lake Ngami, none of them had ever seen or talked to Mr. Ferrini. If we look at his book, in a manuscript of 450 pages, only 16 pages deal with his trip from Lahutu to Lake Ngami. 23 pages later, he's back in Mere, and with the exception of a European settler in Kerasis, the nearest settlement to Mere, he didn't appear to have had any contact with any European settlers. While this certainly doesn't prove him to be deceitful about what he found and how far he travelled, it's far easier to exaggerate your journey and your findings if there is nobody to contradict you. Yeah, like back in the days, like, what's anyone going to say that I lied? You just can't find it, can you, you idiots? Most damningly, however, is the report that Kurt, the guide hitching a ride back to South Africa, later told Professor E.H.L. Schwartz that the stories about the ruins were false, though I couldn't verify this, and Jan Abrahams, when questioned by Dr. Brochures, recalled Ferrini and the hunting trip up the Nosob River, but couldn't recall any ruins being found. Uh-oh. That's pretty damning. According to Ferrini himself, Jan was not particularly interested in the ruins in the first place. However, even if he didn't recall the ruins, I'd expect Jan to, at the very least, recall the crazy Europeans digging in the sand for old rocks. Yeah. He'd be like, I didn't recall any ruins, but I did recall them thinking a lot of weird shit was ruins. It wasn't. They didn't listen to me. Europeans. Ancient civilization in the desert. So, what does this mean for ancient civilizations in the Kalahari? Is it impossible? Definitely not. Many of the expeditions looking for the city and many scientific expeditions into the Kalahari had nothing to do with fabled cities, and they found proof of civilization existing as far back as the Stone Age. Yeah, they found these little tools and trinkets and stuff. However, there is some agreement among scientists that the climate of the Kalahari probably hasn't changed that much in hundreds, if not thousands, of years. The main requirement for a city is water, and water in the Kalahari is scarce and deep underground. Logistically, it's simply not the best place to build a large city. Perini may have exaggerated finding a lost city in the heart of the Kalahari, but I'm not entirely convinced that it was an intentional hoax set up purely for the purpose of fame and fortune. If this was the case, he would have made a much bigger fanfare of the discovery, dedicated far more pages in his book to the lost city, and at the very least hinted to some big reveal in his interview with Argus Reporter. He was a showman after all. Instead, it appears that the story of the city was first mentioned in the Royal Geographical Society lecture delivered before the publication of the book, and then included in the book afterwards when there was some interest in this lost city. In short, I don't believe Farini covered nearly as much ground as he claims, but I do think he came across something interesting. Yeah, Ilstra and I are on exactly the same page with that. Whether it was a natural rock formation or the ruins of a lost civilization, we'll never truly know, since Farini's book is, unfortunately, much like the man himself, larger than life, bordering on fiction, with enough showmanship to keep explorers looking for a lost city over 100 years later, and a YouTube channel and podcast speculating about it. I think he discovered a rock formation and he thought it was something more, or he elaborated it into something more, because that seems in line with his character and what everyone else later found. Do you agree with me? Do you not? Well, there's a comment section below. If you're watching this as a video thing, you can have a go, let me know. And if you're listening as a podcast, thank you so much. It's been great to have you with us as well. A review would be wonderful. 5 stars preferred, but give this podcast what you think it deserves. Like 1 star. Not so great. Okay, fine. It just hurts my soul. Anyway, this has been Decoding the Unknown. Thank you so much for watching or listening, and I'll see you next time.
Have you ever stumbled upon a story that's just too weird to be true?
But too intriguing to ignore?
I'm Laura Anderson.
And I'm Tom Reynolds. Together, we're the hosts of Wanna Hear Something Weird?
A new podcast where we venture into the heart of mind-bending mysteries.
From peculiar legends to ghostly encounters, we try to separate fact from fiction.
Join us on a journey into the bizarre. Listen to Wanna Hear Something Weird wherever you get your podcasts.